I need to show her that I care by being willing to have the conversation. There's good stuff from your family and there's bad stuff from your family. And you guys need to figure out what stuff it is that you want to bring. Our generations need wealth and they need land. So off to conquering we go.
My name is Tim Anderson. Welcome to Father and Friend, where men learn to live for the good of their families.
Today I'm with J. Mike, good friend of mine. J. Mike has 3 children at home and a beautiful wife. And we're going to talk today about some of the things he's doing that is having a positive impact on his family. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we just start with you telling us a little bit about the beginning of your fatherhood journey.
Mm-hmm. The beginning of my fatherhood journey, you know this story. I'll start there, though, because I think that really begins my identity as a father. Was a little bit rocky. We had gotten pregnant, my wife Nicole and I, she had gotten pregnant in 2016, early 2016, and then we were due to have Riker Dietrich by September, and the last week of August we found out that he no longer had a heartbeat. And so because he was so close to term, we had to go through labor and give birth to our stillborn child. Mm-hmm. Turns out he had had a cord accident around his neck, which had cut off blood flow and airflow, obviously. So our first child, we were talking before we got started about how that's a little bit complicated to answer the question, how many kids do you guys have? Because mm-hmm. Really, we have 4, but we're raising 3. And so if a stranger asks, we've got 3 kids. If someone that we're going to have a longer relationship asks, it's, well, that's a harder conversation than that. But that really began my identity as a father, because during that whole pregnancy, I was a 26-year-old kid, essentially. And so I'm trying to figure out what parts of me need to die so that this child can live the fullest life possible that they can. Mm-hmm. And so during that whole pregnancy, there was a lot of figuring out, like, okay, like, here are some areas where I need to grow. You know, then we have the experience that we have, and that forced both me and Nicole to grow in ways that we never anticipated we would have to grow. But I credit my capacity, my emotional capacity to love and care for my 3 children that I'm raising now with Riker's story. Mm-hmm. I would not be near as sensitive or caring of a father that I am now if I didn't have that experience of losing their older brother. Mm.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own upbringing?
Yeah. I grew up one of 5 boys. And so my upbringing was rough and tumble. I always joke with Nicole, I don't understand girls at all. I have 2 of my kids I've got a son and then 2 daughters. And they'll just randomly start screaming. And so I'll look at Nicole and be like, is this normal? She's like, yes, this is girls. I was like, okay, I have no idea that you just randomly start screaming at the top of your lungs at a very high pitch when you're a girl, but that's an experience. So grew up with 4 brothers, very rough and tumble household. We'd wrestle all the time.
By the way, my boys scream very high pitched at the top of their lungs
quite often. I wonder where they learned that, because we didn't in my household growing up. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She homeschooled all of us at some point. At some point, we all eventually went to school, but all of us at some point in our childhood were homeschooled by my mom. And then my dad...
You went to public school later.
I went to private school later.
Private school later,
yeah. Both my older brothers went to private school or public school later. And then both of my younger brothers went to private school or public school later. It all just kind of depended on what my parents could afford, what was convenient, mm-hmm. and what we kind of wanted to do. Mm-hmm.
What was your dad like?
My dad, My dad was always the hardest working person I knew. And that's something I've always said in adulthood is I might not be smarter, stronger, faster than anyone else, but I can dang sure work harder than anyone else just because I saw that modeled. When I was really young, he worked 2 to 3 jobs just to make ends meet. We grew up fairly poor, lower middle class at best until I was probably, maybe 9 or 10 years old. But a huge part of that is just, a huge part of how we got through that was just how hard my dad was willing to work. He'd wake up super early before the sun came up, go start his first job making donuts at Daylight Donuts, and which was inside of Sweet Eugene's in College Station, Texas. Mm-hmm. And then he would go to his second job where he managed Atme Glass, doing auto residential and commercial glass. Eventually, he wound up finding someone who wanted to invest in him and opened up his own glass company, and that's what he's been doing for probably the last 20 years. About 21, 22 years he's been doing that. He was always stressed, I could tell. There'd be times when dad would come home and we were all excited and happy to see him. There'd be times when dad would come home and we were all like, "Dad's home. Like, be quiet." Be quiet. Don't get in his way. You know, make sure your stuff's cleaned up. And as a kid, you don't really understand that. As an adult,
you don't understand the stresses.
You don't understand the stresses. Yeah. You don't understand why sometimes when dad comes in, we're quiet and we get out of his way. And you know, we don't ruffle feathers or anything. I realized in adulthood, one, just the stress of being the sole provider for a family, and working as hard as he did and barely being able to provide, like that's a lot of stress. Two, I've never talked with my dad about this, but I feel confident that this is probably a part of his story. Before he was married and had children, he always had money. He managed a restaurant. That's actually where my mom and dad met. My mom was a hostess at the restaurant that my dad ran. And if he went out with his friends, he was buying drinks, he was buying dinner, he had money to spend. And then he got married and the responsibility of taking care of another person. And then they had my oldest brother pretty quickly after they got married. I think it was maybe just about a year after they got married. The stress of raising a child, that money doesn't go quite as far as it does for a bachelor. And I think he didn't realize that until he wasn't a bachelor. And then it's like, wow, I make more money now than I did when I was a bachelor, and I can't afford anything.
But I'm poorer than I was
but
then.
But I'm poorer than I was then, which I've had that realization many times. Yeah. It's like, hun, we make more money than we've ever made, and we can't afford anything. You know, credit the economy, credit your budget, whatever it is. That happens. That's part of it.
Yeah. I did the math once on my kids and eating, because I'm every month I'm like, I can't believe we spent so much on food.
Spent a mortgage on your grocery bill.
Oh, yeah, easily. And I did the math once, and if I put it at like $3 a day, you know, 3 times 8 of us, times 3. So what is that? 24 times. So it's like $60, $70 a day, you know, times 30.
Yeah, times a month.
So you suddenly got to $2,000 really, really fast.
Yeah.
So, and you know, sometimes I think it's sometimes less than that. Maybe it's if maybe you can get away with some meals that are $1 or $2 a person. You
sometimes
know?
Leftovers happen.
That's right. But you know, just the fact that the way the multiplication works, the way the math works on it, always blows my mind.
Compounding interest works both ways.
Yeah, yeah, it does. So, sorry, I just want to make sure this is still working well. Cool. So yes, I've been blown away by that and the cost of things once you get a family. So
yep.
What did you learn from your dad that you felt like was good?
Probably the thing that sticks out the most is don't quit. I remember I was probably 11 or 12 years old. I made the all-star team in baseball. The head coach asked my dad to come and help assist coaching. And I loved playing baseball growing up, but for whatever reason, on this all-star team, I was not having fun. I didn't like the position that I was put in. I think the team was fine. I didn't know some of the guys, but over the course of a few weeks, when you're 12, now they're your friends. But I remember having a conversation with my dad, like, "Dad, I want to quit." Like, you know, we hadn't even played a game yet. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be on the all-star team. He was like, "You're not going to quit. Maybe
so good luck with that."
Yeah, he's like,
"We're going.
Yeah, you're not going to quit. You committed to be on this team, and you're going to finish being on this team. Maybe we lose the first game, and all you got to do is play one game." We didn't. I think we went 3 or 4 games deep into the All-Star tournament, but he wouldn't let me quit. He was like, "No, you made a commitment. You're going to honor that commitment." Mm-hmm. That's something that I've carried into adulthood. The job I'm at now, I've been here almost 6 years now, but when I took the job, I didn't make this commitment to the company. I made this commitment to myself, but I'd made the commitment to the company that, yeah, I'll work here. But I made a commitment to myself. It's like, I'm a millennial, and millennials have a bad rap of they stay in a job for 2 to 3 years and then they split and they go to another job. The reasons for that, but what I made a commitment to is I don't want to be seen as just another millennial employee. I'm going to commit to 5 years at this company, and I'm going to work for this company for 5 years. And I met that commitment. And year 4 and 5 were not fun years to work at the company. We've been going through, my company got bought out by another company, and we've been going through those growing pains, and the culture of the company is not what it was when I came on. And it's not that it's bad now, it's different. Mm-hmm. But your perspective coming into a situation when it's like, you know, here's my culture, and now all of a sudden the culture's changed. Doesn't matter if it's good or bad when it changes, it's different. And so now your perspective is it's bad because it's not what it was.
Yeah. And for those who are listening, you work in residential new construction.
Correct. Yep. I'm in residential construction. Mm-hmm. My job title would be a home builder. Mm-hmm. And it's a great company, still a great company, but I had to work through that personal challenge of just, this is different. It's a different company now. It's not the company that, you know, I signed up with. But I had made that commitment of, I'm going to work here for 5 years. And at points when it was challenging and I wanted to go send applications to other home builders and go start over somewhere, I thought back to that all-star team and, you know, my dad saying, "No, you made a commitment and you're going to honor that commitment." I think that's, you know, there's lots of lessons we learned from our fathers, but to me, I think that's the most probably, the most tangible one,
the one that I can identify.
The one that I can touch the quickest.
Yeah, making your yes a yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you've thought to yourself, I want this to be different in my family than it was in my family growing up?
For sure. Nicole and I were fortunate that we had really good premarital counseling. The pastor and his wife that did our premarital counseling, they talked a lot about that, of you guys are coming together and conversation on culture again, like you guys are going to create your own family culture. Mm-hmm. And you're both going to bring things from your previous family into this family culture. Mm-hmm. And there's good stuff from your family and there's bad stuff from your family. And you guys need to figure out what stuff it is that you want to bring and what stuff you absolutely don't want to bring so that you don't accidentally bring those negative things in. Probably the biggest dichotomy between Nicole's family and my family is I always equate it to a milk run and how a milk run works in my family and how a milk run works in her family.
You're talking about going to the store to get milk?
Going to the store to get milk.
Okay.
Hey, we're out of milk. I'm going to go to the store and get milk. Mm-hmm. In my family, hey, we're out of milk. Guys, I'm going to run and get milk. grab your keys, you walk out the door, you go get milk, you come back. Maybe someone heard you, maybe they didn't, but you went, you got milk, you came back. Now there's milk in the fridge. Mm-hmm. And her family...
Solve the problem right then.
Solve the problem.
Yeah, there you go.
They may walk into the living room and go, oh, where's J. Mike? But 10 minutes later, I'm going to be back because I just went down the street and I grabbed milk and I came back. In Nicole's family, it's, hey, we're out of milk. I need to go get milk. Okay, cool. I'm going to go let these people know that you're going to go on a milk run and see if they need anything. And I'll be right back. They go, they have a conversation, they come back. Hey, they don't need anything, but if you can wait an hour, then they're going to need to go to X, Y, or Z and blah, blah, blah. With her family, putting a positive spin on it, because again, it's not my family, so I don't see it the same way she does.
Not your preference.
Yes.
Yeah.
Putting a positive spin on it, her family, a milk run is a communal opportunity. Mm. Where we can invite everyone, we can figure out who all needs to go. Oh, the whole family needs to go somewhere. We'll all pile in. We'll all go on the milk run. Whereas in my family, it's purely utilitarian. We're out of milk. We need milk. I got milk. There's milk. Mm-hmm. And that's very much how our two families function. Just the ethos of how our families work. Bare bones. In conflict... these are some negative things that we decided, hey, I don't like this about my family. Let's not bring this into our marriage. So her family would, in conflict, just have an argument right then and there as soon as the conflict came up loudly so that everyone could hear, communal. Mm-hmm. and then after it got really heated, someone would crack a joke. Everyone would kind of chuckle except for the offended party who would kind of like brush it off, and then everyone would move on. And in my family, if we addressed the issue, it's going to be very passive aggressive and we're probably just not going to address it. We're probably just never going to speak to each other ever again. We're going to sweep it under the rug. Mm-hmm. And
how long does that last? A week? Day?
I have, brothers who still do not talk to one another.
Oh, wow. So, literally.
It can last years.
Wow.
And if they ever did just sit down and talk with one another, they'd be over it in like 5 or 10 minutes. But it's, you got to have someone who's willing to make that first step. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the lesson that we learned is someone has to be willing to make the first step to, for me, it was, I got to be able to take the first step or at least allow her to take the first step. Mm. Because early in our marriage, it's like, I don't want to deal with this. Mm. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to have conflict. But from her, it was, if we're not screaming about this, then you don't care about me. Mm. And so we had to learn that, like, I need to show her that I care by being willing to have the conversation. She needs to allow her emotions to diffuse so that we can come together and have a meaningful conversation and actually grow. Conflict's an opportunity for growth.
Yeah.
It's
make progress.
It's an opportunity to strengthen the bond of a relationship.
Yeah.
And if you can learn how to manage conflict well in any given relationship, then conflict is actually a great opportunity. And so now, we're... almost 12 years into our marriage now. Now when conflict comes up, we're frustrated because emotions exist and emotions come like that. And, but you process that emotion and you say, no, that feeling, while it may or may not be valid, but I can't let that color my perspective of this other person because I love and care about this person.
So do you feel like that approach to conflict resolution that was practiced in your family growing up, across the board, like dad to children, children to children, and the idea that we have an argument and then we just kind of get over it and we move on without really resolving it?
That's pretty much how conflict was resolved, yeah, pretty much in all the relationships. And I heard my mom and dad fight maybe twice. Mm. And I think those were just very stressful times for them where the conflict kind of just boiled over to where, oh, we heard them argue. Mm-hmm. So conflict was very much modeled, you know, in this relationship and this relationship. So parent to children, children to one another, children to parent, all the relationships, it was pretty much like, yeah, sweep it under the rug. Mm.
So you've chosen to approach conflict in a healthier way than you feel like you experienced growing up?
I feel like it's healthier.
Yeah.
It has certainly been healthier in my marriage than the alternative. Mm. If I were to sweep conflict, part of it is you have to understand conflict, but you also have to understand the person that you're in conflict with and how they view conflict. If I swept every conflict that came up in my marriage under the rug, Nicole would suffer. Like, it would be like poison to her because she's never going to let go of these things because they've never been addressed. Mm. Whereas for me, like, it's also knowing, like, there are some conflicts where it's like, we don't need to talk about this. This is small. This doesn't matter. But both parties have to recognize that. Mm. So it's like, you know, it's the end of a stressful day. The kids have been screaming all day. Nicole's been home with them. They haven't been listening. And I had a terrible day at work, and we get home and we're trying to figure out dinner and we're being short with one another. And then someone, you know, kind of is snappy with the other person. It's like, we both just need to take a breath and let this one go. We don't need to talk about this one. Like, it's just, you take a breath, I take a breath. Like, it was a bad day. Bad days happen. We're going to get through it. We don't need to discover the root of what this problem is, because we already know what it is. Mm-hmm. So let's just move past this one.
And I suppose also it's not really a conflict between us so much as it is we're both stressed about different things, and that is boiling over into our relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of the difference between, you know, accidentally spilling a little drop of water on your kitchen floor and then dropping the milk jug on the floor. It's like, oops, I accidentally spilled a little drop of water. That's fine. I'll rub my sock over it. We'll move on. We'll clean the floor later. Mm-hmm. Oh, I dropped an entire jug of milk. We need to stop and address that. Mm-hmm. I'll get the mop. You get the paper towels. Let's get together and let's start working.
It needs direct attention.
Yes, yeah. It needs direct attention. It's a much bigger mess. Mm-hmm. You get to a point when you learn how to manage conflict where you start to realize that's a drop of water. Like, yeah, it was never my intention to hurt your feelings. I know that I probably did when I came in here and I was acting like a grouch. Mm-hmm. You probably didn't mean to make me feel disrespected when you were short with me when I asked a question and blah, blah, blah. But if it, you know, if I come in and I say something really mean and hurtful that cuts her deep, it's like, no, we need to have that conversation. Like, why'd you say what you said? Like, could you have worded that differently? If what you said is true, you probably need to word that differently and approach it with more humility than just using it as a weapon.
Mm. That's good. Awesome. Well, let's jump into the three or four things that we discussed previously.
I gave you a bonus one.
You did. You gave me a bonus.
Yeah.
So the first one was that with your children, you don't dumb down any language. You don't baby talk, and you don't avoid topics. Describe that to me.
Yes. So, and that's not my original idea. That comes from an English teacher I had in college.
Okay.
Her son was three at the time that she was teaching me, and he spoke very intelligently. He could hold an adult conversation with an adult, and I was really curious about that. So I asked her, like, you know, is he just this smart, or is this something you've done? And she was like, the way that I'm talking to you now is the way that I talk to him. I don't baby talk him. You know, I don't have different words for his anatomy and my anatomy. I call them what they are. I don't, you know, I don't ask him to go get his, you know, bookie or whatever. Go grab your blanket. It's a blanket. Go grab your blanket. We don't have nicknames for things. And probably to some people, it feels like you're stealing their childhood. And it's like, I promise my kids have a wonderful childhood. but I also promise you that any one of my kids will come up to an adult and just start having a conversation with them. Obviously, my youngest, she's two. Some words come just out really great. But she'll walk right up to you and just start babbling at you as if you're having a conversation with her. And then when she feels satisfied that you've had a conversation, she'll walk away. But my oldest will have a full-on conversation with an adult. Obviously, he's got a child's understanding of things, but he uses words that sometimes he uses words that were like, what? Where did you learn that? He's like, I don't know. And I was like, I guess you absorb things that we say. And I feel like what that does is it makes them feel respected, because we're not talking to them differently than we do our friends or their grandparents or their uncles and aunts. Another part of that is if I need to have like a direct conversation with one of them, I'm not standing up, because that puts me in a position where I'm superior to you right now. Obviously, there are times when it's like I'm trying to correct them for being disobedient or defiant or something, and I'm angry, so I'm going to stay standing. And But if I have to, it's like if I've got my oldest Sawyer, it's like if I've got to spank him because he did something that's just utterly defiant, and it's like you need to understand there's bad consequences with bad decisions, I'm going to go spank him, but then I'm going to get down on my knees and look him in the eyes and explain to him, like, this is what you did. This is why it's wrong. This is what it did to the relationship with the person that you wronged, and you need to go and ask for their forgiveness over this. And that may seem like a lot to explain to a 7-year-old, but most of the time he understands, like, yeah, I hurt that relationship and I need to go make it right. So that's kind of what I mean by not dumbing down. We don't use different words for things. We use the words of what they are. The most obvious example of that is like human anatomy. He knows that he has a penis, and not some other strange name for it.
We had some guests come over to our house not too long ago, and for some reason I don't know if they talk about it. I think it's literally just observation.
Yep.
But they would, and you know, they take showers together at times because they're still young.
Yeah.
And we sat at the table, and Abraham, who's 2, said, "I have a big penis." And we're like, awesome. And then he was like,
cool.
"I have a bigger penis than you." We're like, okay, thank you. Yes, great observation.
Yeah, yeah. Gender is a construct, man. I think he probably came by that one naturally.
It's amazing that even at that age, men are already doing the same things.
We're simple creatures. We're not hard to figure out, that's for sure.
But I'd much rather him say that than use some other strange term for it.
Yeah.
You know, that is probably sounds even more immature and vulgar. You know?
Yeah.
Well, at least in that scenario, he's literally just saying something that's on his mind.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know there's some social etiquette to when you would say those things.
For sure. Well, and he said it with total confidence, too.
Oh, super confident.
I think that's another thing, that just talking to your kid like a person, because that's what they are. They're a person. I think sometimes we forget our children are their people. But talking to them like that, it gives them confidence where they will be bold. And for us, for me and Nicole, it's not something that keeps us up at night, but it's something that, you know, people are cognizant of nowadays. Like, wicked people exist and they will do wicked things to innocent people. And so for us, it's kind of a safety thing in our family too, where if my kid feels confident and he knows the names of things and the terms of things, he's not going to be manipulated into doing something he doesn't want to do or she doesn't want to do. And they're also probably more likely to be able to communicate to us that something happened that they're not comfortable with. And then we can take whatever action we need to.
That's great. I love that. So the... Oh, yes. You also said you don't avoid topics.
Yes.
So talk about that a little bit.
We don't avoid topics.
Were you talking about the words, the anatomy, or...
Pretty much in most things. There are obviously some topics where it's like, this is a little bit of a challenge for someone of your age to understand. It's like... Sawyer, he knows he's not the oldest brother. He knows that Riker exists and that he's no longer here. He knows what death is. Funny story, I was at a PGA tournament and took Sawyer along with me, and we were watching all the pros hit at the driving range. There's a little barrier there, so I'm standing at the barrier, and he's kind of playing right behind me. And there was another couple there. They had 2 kids, older brother, younger brother. And he just looked right at the parents and said, "My older brother died." And I was like, really glad for the boldness strong time. I think he was like 3 or 4 years old at the time, but he understood what the concept of death was. It's because we did, like, death wasn't off the table. We would talk about that from a very young age. We would talk to him about Riker. You know, you've got an older brother, Riker. He's no longer with us. He's in heaven with Jesus. That kind of thing. Colorful language. That's a conversation I'm having with him right now because he said that, it's not a bad one, but can I say the word? He said the word damn at church in front of our group's pastor.
Good parenting, J. Mike.
In context.
Oh, did he?
In context. Oh, nice. I was like, oh, no. So I had to have the conversation. Where'd you hear that word? You know, oh, I don't know. Like, I think he probably heard it from my
dad. My dad.
From you. I heard it from you. You said it. So I had to have a conversation with him about, okay, here's what that word is, and here's what it means, and here's why it's not appropriate for you to say. Maybe one day, if you choose to, you can use that word, because you nailed the context. But right now, I need you not to use that word. Mm. You know, you can use "aw shucks" instead, and something like that. You know, but more appropriate word for a 7-year-old. And the way I kind of put it to him is like leveling up, like in a video game. Mm. It's like right now you're 7 years old, and you need to use words that are appropriate for a 7-year-old. You're not leveled up to be able to use these words because you don't know what these words mean. You don't know what these words do to people emotionally.
Mm. You don't know how people receive
these. You don't know how people receive these words. And so it's not that I think you're dumb, but it is that I don't think that you have a maturity level enough yet to be trusted with those words. And I think just being honest, you know, we're not avoiding the topic. I'm not going to brush it under the rug. Like, we're going to address it, and we're going to have the conversation about it. And I think that lets him feel respected. Because I think that's something that often we don't do, is make sure that our children feel like they're respected. And, you know, I get it, the argument, they're a child, they haven't done anything worthy of respect. Yeah, they haven't. But they're also human, and humans long to be respected.
I was talking about this kind of similar topic with someone just recently, and there is this tendency, I mean, and I've probably fallen into this before, and not maybe overtly, but the way I maybe forgetting that the life the child is living is their real life. It's not some pre-life before their real life.
Yeah.
When their toy breaks, that is the equivalent of my car breaking.
Yeah.
Or someone smashing my guitar on the floor, or someone pushing my computer off my desk.
Yeah. Joe Rogan says all the time, the hardest thing you've ever gone through is the hardest thing you've ever gone through.
And that's
right. Yeah. For a 5-year-old, my toy broke.
Yeah. Or my brother pushing me over.
Someone said something mean. That's probably the hardest thing they've ever gone through.
Yeah. I mean, think about how angry adults get at each other when someone pushes them. So it's not that surprising that when two little kids push each other over,
they
do the same thing.
They get offended.
You know, if we imagine what that feels like for someone to take advantage of us, and, you know, we feel that sense of, like, that welling up of anger, you know, over the injustice.
Yeah, I'm going to push you back.
Yeah.
Or worse.
Yeah, I got to one-up you.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, there's something really healthy about seeing your children as a full human.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's something that's easy to forget.
With less experience, but
yes,
a full human, well, nonetheless.
There's an innocence there that makes them seem different. Mm. It's like if you meet a very innocent adult. Well, we wouldn't call them innocent. We would call them naive because they're different. And so we have to have a term to distinguish that they're different. That guy's kind of naive. He's probably just really innocent and lived a very, like, protected life from bad things happening to him. So he doesn't understand some things that you understand because you had a harder life than he did. Mm. Children are innocent. Unfortunately, some kids have a much harder life. And I've talked to some kids that have had some pretty rough lives, and it's like talking to an adult because that innocence
it's been lost a little bit.
It's been lost a little bit. Mm. Fortunately, right now, my kids are still fairly innocent, and I hope that they remain so. I don't want them to be naive, but I don't want them to have their innocence stolen from them either. Mm-hmm. What I pray for them, Jordan Peterson talks about the loss of innocence like this. He says that everyone has innocence or naivety, and the loss of innocence leads into cynicism. The problem is a lot of people get stuck in cynicism because they don't have the tools to get through it. But where wisdom begins is when innocence is lost and cynicism is worked through. That's when you become wise. You can't become wise without becoming cynical first. So my prayer for my children is that one day you do lose your innocence, but it's on your terms. And you have the necessary tools. That's kind of my goal in fatherhood, is I want... Nicole and I always said before we started a family, we always said, I rephrase this now, but at the time we'd say it's guaranteed one thing, our kids are going to turn 18, they're gonna move out of the house. I had many people correct me and they're like, not always. So not always,
sure. But,
our hope is our kids turn 18, and they have some level of independence. So that's how we've kind of rephrased it. And our goal as parents is not to raise a doctor, not to raise a lawyer, not to raise the world's most successful entrepreneur or anything. Our goal as parents is we want our children to grow up knowing that Jesus loves them, and our hope and prayer is that they know and love Jesus, and that they are competent adults who can take care of themselves and others. And if both of those things are accomplished, then we've succeeded as parents. A part of becoming a competent adult that can care for themselves and others is that loss of innocence, but they have to have the tools to get through that cynicism into wisdom.
That's good. You mentioned prayers, and the second item on your list is that you pray the same prayers morning and evening with your children. Can you describe what that looks like and how you started that and how you go about doing it now?
Yes, I can for sure tell you the evening one because I'm in charge of saying the evening one. My oldest child, Sawyer, is actually in charge of leading the morning one, so I'll do my best to remember it, but I'm usually repeating him, so he's got it down.
How did you start doing this, first of all?
When I was in college, a mentor of mine gave me a book of Puritan prayers. I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically a Puritan prayer book. And I haven't cracked open that book in a long time, but what I would do in college and in young adulthood as well, some of them were topical, some of them were just general, but if there was a thing that I was struggling with and I didn't know how to pray about it, I would just turn to that and I would memorize that prayer and I would pray that prayer. There's a tendency for Protestants to think, or modern Protestants, American Protestants to think that because a thing is written down, it's not a genuine prayer, and that's not true. You just read me a poem before we got started, and I didn't feel like that poem was insincere because it was written down in a book. So that kind of shaped my thinking on pre-written prayers. Another term that you can use for this is liturgy. We have a family liturgy. And so before my kids go to bed, and we've done this since Sawyer was a little baby, I pray the same prayer over all of them. It goes, Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for your son Jesus, for his death and his resurrection, and how that changes the way that we relate with you. I ask that Sawyer, Eloise, and Olivia would come to know you at young ages and choose to live by your truths. So that covers both your Arminius and your Calvinists. We got both covered. Lord, I ask that you would give them all good night's sleep. In Jesus' name, amen. So very simple prayer. It covers a few bases. Is one, like, we got through this day, and that's a gift from God. We know where our salvation comes from and who our Lord is. It's Jesus. He died, was buried, and resurrected, and that changes the way that we relate to God. If he didn't do that, we would relate to God in a different way. We wouldn't be coming directly to him. We come directly to him through Christ. And so I'm preaching the gospel to my children as I pray over them at night. And then I our goal is for our children to know that Jesus loves them and for them to love Jesus by the time they're adults. And so I pray that at an early age they come to know you, because I do subscribe to Reformed theology, but I also think that there's human free will and we have a responsibility to make a decision. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're covering both Calvinist and Arminianist, because I think that's better theology. Christ reveals himself to my, Christ reveal yourself to my children, mm-hmm. and then give them the wisdom and love of you to choose to follow you. Mm-hmm. And then you guys can all argue about how that all plays out on your own. And then I want them to sleep well, because if they sleep well, my wife's going to have an easier morning, mm-hmm. When I run off to work and they're not all cranky and arguing with one another. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a better day when they go throughout the day and they're not super emotional and they don't understand why, because they're tired and they're young and they don't know that when you're tired, you get irrationally emotional. Mm.
So you started doing this when Sawyer was a baby.
Yes.
And you've continued to do it. I imagine it's not 100%. It's like very close to 100%.
Yeah.
It's missing that here and there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, and I'm a musician, so I travel, and so oftentimes I miss bedtime. Mm-hmm. But if I'm there for bedtime, I'm praying that prayer. Mm-hmm. Nicole has written another prayer down as well.
Did you write that one?
I made it. I haven't written it down.
Okay.
But yeah, I made
you that made that one.
Yeah, I made that mm-hmm. one. And she has another one that she wrote down more recently. I think it was about a year ago that we sometimes will pray over the kids. I don't know that one. It's written on a piece of paper in their room that we have hanging there in their room, so we'll always refer to that if we're going to pray that one over. But I like that one because we're praying over their entire body. It's I won't get this exactly right, but it's essentially like, you know, Lord, bless their hands and we'll touch their hands, that they can take care of the poor. Lord, bless their heads that they could make wise decisions. It's basically like that. You kind of start from the head and work all the way down to their feet, and mm-hmm. may you guide their feet to where you would have them go. Mm-hmm. So that's a cool prayer as well. We kind of started implementing that one over the last year.
That's neat.
Yeah.
And then there's a morning one.
The morning one, let me see if I can remember it. I'm going to kick myself if I can't, but again, I don't lead this one.
Who leads this one? Usually Nicole.
Nicole wrote this one. Sawyer leads it. He's kind of
bring Sawyer up here.
We got to bring Sawyer over here. He's kind of taking the initiative. I won't remember it. I can't remember how it goes. It rhymes, and maybe I still have a little bit of cynicism in me, and I'm like, oh, this rhymes. This is
you feel like it's less authentic because it rhymes.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, maybe deep down I do. On the surface, no, I wouldn't say that. But I have not committed that one to memory. But we've only been doing that one for about a year as well. But essentially, we're thanking the Lord for the day. Will you bless us as we work, study, and play? Because I'm working, Nicole's working. They're studying and playing, mm-hmm. so it's covering all the activities that we have planned for the day. Mm-hmm. Be present with us in all that we do. Remind us that, if we don't feel like God's present, He's present. Mm-hmm. It's our problem, not His. Mm-hmm. And may we bring glory and honor to You. That's basically it. That's about probably 75% of it.
Yeah.
Missing
some of the rhymes.
Missing some of the rhymes. Yeah.
That's really great. That's fantastic. So you've been, Sawyer's seven. So you've been doing the evening prayer for 6-ish years, I would guess.
Yeah. That's why it's locked in there.
And then you've been doing the morning one for a year or so.
Yeah.
That's really great. Now, do you get everybody together for that before bedtime, or do you just say it when they lay down? What's your routine?
It's the last thing I do before I leave the room at bedtime. So okay. I'll tell them all good night. And then I'll say the prayer after I've turned out the lights, and then I'll leave the room. Nicole will sing two songs to them, and then she'll leave the room. Hmm. Unless my middle child says, Dad, will you stay for the songs? Then I'll be like, yeah, I'll stay for the songs.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. After you've prayed, you ensure that you don't tell them they're smart. So tell me something about that.
Yes.
This is number three.
I believe this is another thing that I got from Jordan Peterson, I think it is. The wrestling thing is something that I got from Jordan Peterson.
Which is number four.
Which is number four, the bonus. we don't tell... It's not from Jordan Peterson. It's from Andrew Huberman.
Okay.
Who's a brain scientist.
Okay.
Smart guy. But he referenced a study where individuals who are told they are smart will rely on their smartness to get them success. And I'm not wording this exactly how he did, but this is essentially what the study showed. People who are told that they worked hard will work hard for their success. And basically what the study showed is children who were told that they were smart became lazy because they thought, well, I'm smart, I don't have to work hard, and so I'll just figure it out and we'll go from there. My children are smart. My children are very intelligent. Sawyer is 7 years old. He's already read almost every Dog Man book that Dave Pilkey has written. I think there's three of them that he hasn't read yet. My middle child is already reading. She's not reading books just yet, but she's 4 years old and she's already reading. My youngest will walk up and she'll go, "O for Olivia." It's like, that's right. O for Olivia. E for Eloise. That's right. E. So they're very intelligent children. We don't tell them they're intelligent because intelligence is already taken care of. God gave them that. That's covered. But we have to teach them to work hard. And if a neuroscientist is going to come to me and say that the way that the brain develops, if you tell them that they're smart, they're going to become lazy, I'm going to take that and I'm going to go, okay, cool. I'm going to tell them, hey, great job at that. You worked really hard. So when Sawyer, you know, writes a letter and gets 98% of the spelling correct and his E's are all facing the right direction, I'm going to look at that and I'm going to go, great job, dude. You worked really hard at this. Like, you know, well done. I'm not going to say, man, you're so smart, because I don't want them to rely on their intelligence. Their intelligence will take them where their intelligence takes them. But if they're willing to work hard, their intelligence is going to take them a lot further.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, intelligence without hard work doesn't take you far, but hard work without intelligence will generally sustain you much, much longer.
Yes.
Yeah, and much farther.
Yeah.
And obviously the two combined.
Yeah. I just...
Intelligence without work is almost meaningless.
Yeah. If you... I mean... I'm certain that every, you know, 35-year-old guy living in his mom's basement isn't dumb. I'm sure some of them were really great in high school, had a lot of potential. They just were lazy and they weren't willing to... It's like anything, you know. There's a difference between sitting down and making a whole plan and then just going out and bootstrapping it and doing the thing. Steve Jobs, I'm certain, wrote many business plans, but I'm willing to bet when he was working there in the garage, he was just bootstrapping it. He was just like, I'm going to work really hard and I'm going to get this thing going. And then later... He got to then implement all the business plans and everything. But I think sometimes, especially with aspiring entrepreneurs, and I can say this because I would love to own my own business one day, and I've done this. There's a tendency to be mystified by the planning, and never actually stepping out of your door. Get to the doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what holds a lot of people back is. They feel like the plan's not ready yet.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just got to start. Step one.
Sometimes you got to go without a plan.
Yeah, just do it.
Yeah. It's Bilbo leaving the Shire. He didn't know what was going on. He just left. And then he wound up having the adventure of a lifetime. And
I heard a presentation recently, and the person giving the presentation, I'm not sure if they got this from somebody, but you've heard the phrase, knowledge is power. And they... clarified and said, knowledge isn't power. Applied knowledge is power. Same principle.
Yes. That
you can have knowledge, but if it's just sitting there, who cares? Doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
You need to apply it to something. To your hands and your feet. And
yeah.
It would, making something, creating something.
It would be like if a military just bought
bunch of weapons.
1,000 sniper rifles.
Right, right.
And then put them in strategic positions. But they never put a soldier behind that sniper rifle.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you got to have someone to use the knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's great. Wrestling. This is the last one. So, this, you wrestle. Yeah. Let me hear this.
So, I grew up in a family of 5 boys.
So you guys wrestled all the time.
We wrestled all the time.
Nonstop.
Every opportunity. Nonstop. You know, and it never ended until someone fell off the bed and scraped their back on the desk, or, you know, got pinned between the bed and the wall, or landed on their head, and then it's like, okay, we're done now.
We've gone too far.
Yeah. We'll stop. But us, so me and Nicole wrestling with the kids, that's we're stealing that straight from Jordan Peterson. Mm-hmm. He talks about a part of a child's cognitive development. It's really important, especially for the father, to wrestle with the children because it helps them understand social barriers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be much easier for me to push things too far and they have to scream uncle and stop the wrestling because I'm 3 times their size. Mm-hmm. And so they start to recognize, okay, if I call for help, he's going to stop. So that if then they're in a situation and someone, you know, calls for help or says stop, they're going to be more inclined to do that because they recognize that pattern from the wrestling. Mm-hmm. It also creates connection. It's a very easy way to play with your children.
Did you say that you and Nicole wrestle with them?
Yeah. Not at the same time. We'll do it at different times.
Not like
times.
WWF tag team?
Yeah, exactly. We're not jumping off the ropes and body slamming them.
You're in, Nicole.
Yeah. It's more so just like, for me, it's just like, I'm going to grab them and they can't escape. And then I'm going to tickle them. And they're going to, you know, we're going to be rolling around on the bed and... Then they escaped, and that gives them, that rewards them, that gets them a dopamine hit, because they're like, oh, I escaped from dad, and even though they don't realize, it's like, yeah, I let you escape. That's a dopamine hit for me. But it's a way that you can play with them. Apart from throwing the baseball and, you know, giving us birthday spankings on our birthdays, my dad didn't really play with us. We'd play card games and stuff from time to time, but it's not like he got down on his hands and knees and played with toys with me.
Just to clarify, when you said you got birthday spankings since your birthday, that was like funny.
Yeah, it's like, you turned 9, you get 9 and 1 to grow on. Yeah, that whole thing. We don't do that with our kids just because we never started that.
Yeah.
So our kids would be like, what?
I do what not you, want that yeah, on my what birthday. Are you doing?
Yeah, they would be weird to them. We just never started it. But in my family growing up, we did birthday spankings just as kind of like a gag.
Yeah.
But I'm not like super comfortable getting down on my hands and knees and playing with Legos with Sawyer or playing with dolls with the girls. I will do it from time to time, especially if they ask me directly, hey, will you do X, Y, or Z?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so happy when it's like, I can't, I gotta go help mom with dinner because it's really uncomfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can wrestle, like that's a thing that I can bond with my children through that playfulness
mm-hmm.
without it feeling kind of, because they can tell it's like, dad's not enjoying this. And I don't want them to think like, dad's not enjoying playing with me.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to feel loved and cared for and like I really enjoy them. And I do enjoy, like when I am playing with them, it's like I enjoy watching you play, but I have a 34-year-old's imagination and not a 4-year-old's imagination.
Mm.
And so, you know, I'm going to let you kind of run the show here. Mm. Whereas if we're wrestling, it's like it doesn't really take both of our imagination to do that. We're just playing together.
You don't have to pretend he's an elephant.
Exactly. Or... yeah, I don't have to pretend he's an elephant, and I don't have to talk in a girl voice because I have Ariel. Exactly.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's really great. Well, I think we've talked about so many good things. We've talked about the not dumbing down language, praying morning and evening, telling your kids they've worked hard, and then physically engaging them with wrestling. I love that. So, any final things you would like to share?
Nothing comes to mind.
Cool. Man. Well, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, awesome.
Fellow fathers and friends, so glad you could join us for this episode. To stay connected, visit our website at fatherandfriend.com. Sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media sites. Be sure to like, follow, and share with fellow dads and families in your community. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, send us a message and let us know. Until our next episode, keep showing up, loving deeply, and making an impact for the good of your family. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Father and Friend.